This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Memory is very imperfect, and those imperfections can drive you crazy, whether you've forgotten the name of someone you work with, forgotten where you put your keys, or can barely remember the details of a life-changing experience. My guest, Daniel Schachter, has spent about 20 years investigating how memory works. His new book is about how the mind forgets, remembers, and distorts the past, and what we're learning about that from new medical technology. He proposes that there are seven different types of memory malfunctions, which is why he titled his book The Seven Sins of Memory. Schachter is chair of Harvard's psychology department. Here's a typical memory problem. You leave home, then halfway down the street you wonder, did I lock the door? Did I turn off the coffee pot? I asked Daniel Schachter what it takes to make a memory of an everyday task.
One of the nice things about our cognitive system is that it allows us to do a lot of everyday tasks on automatic. However, memory very much requires attention and what psychologists call elaborative encoding in order to establish a memory of a new event. So you've got to attend to that event, relate it to things that you already know in order to lay down the kind of information that you can later consciously retrieve. And if you're mind is off somewhere else, you're not attending to the event, then you're not going to establish a memory that you can later retrieve.
So if you're, say, very busy and you're doing several things at once, are you less likely to remember things and more likely to be absent-minded?
Absolutely. That's probably the most or one of the most common sources of absent-mindedness. And it's been shown over and over again in laboratory studies that when you divide attention, you have people doing a number of things. One of those things is trying to learn a list of words or a series of pictures or whatever the experimenter shows them, that when you divide attention, you have a devastating effect on later memory.
Let's get to another problem of memory, which is transience, the fact that memories fade or become inaccurate over time. A good example that you give in your book is a research project that was conducted in California about how well people remembered where they were when the O.J. Simpson verdict came down. Would you describe the study?
Yeah, that was a very interesting study. What they did is they asked some university students several days after the verdict to write down their memories of how they had heard about the verdict, where they were, and so on and so forth, on the assumption that memories at this point after a couple days would be pretty accurate. The interesting part of the study occurred when they brought these students back later, about 15 months later, and now they asked them again, how did you hear about the verdict? And what they found is that only about half accurately recalled how they found out about the verdict. And when they brought them back again nearly 3 years later, less than a third of the students now accurately recalled what they remembered. So there was a dramatic fading of memory over time, and they even distorted their memories and started to remember details that were actually inaccurate.
Why do memories fade or become inaccurate over time?
There are probably a number of reasons. One has to do with interference. So we have many other experiences that may be similar in some ways, and we may so any individual experience may be harder to pull out because you're now trying to pull it out from a whole collection of similar experiences which may interfere with it in some ways. There may be some room for just passive decay or weakening of information over time. We know that memories are stored in neural connections, connections between neurons, and there's some evidence from studies of animals that those connections may spontaneously weaken over time. So it's probably not so much time itself, but what happens in the time interval. Now, another important thing to keep in mind about transience is that it differs in very interesting ways from absent-mindedness. They both are forms of forgetting, but people often confuse them. And I think that the confusion can sometimes lead people to worry, perhaps needlessly, about developing conditions such as Alzheimer's disease. In a condition like Alzheimer's disease, we see greatly accelerated transience. That is, patients have a great difficulty holding on to information, you know, for more than a few minutes. This can be a very dramatic kind of condition. It's nicely illustrated in the recent movie Memento, which you may have seen, where there's the main character can't establish, can't make new memories and hold on to them. That is very characteristic of a condition such as Alzheimer's disease. But people often get worried that they're developing this condition when, in fact, what they're suffering from is absent-mindedness, failures of at the interface between attention and memory, and not this accelerated transience that really is a serious sign of decline.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about transience, about forgetting over the course of time the details of what happened or what happened to you. And that can be really disturbing when you don't even remember the story of your own life over time, you know? Are there ways of keeping those memories more alive without writing a journal? So that, I mean, that's one technique. You write a journal, you've got it recorded. Even if you don't remember, the book does. But short of doing a journal, is there a way of reinforcing an accurate memory in your mind so that it endures over time?
Yes. There are basically two ways to go after it. One is at the time of initial encoding, trying to elaborate on an experience as it's occurring, trying to link incoming information to things that we already know. Now, that's a lot of work for most of us to go around. We can't go around every minute of our lives trying to actively relate incoming information to things we already know, making up images, stories, and associations. But to the extent that we can, that will increase the durability of the memory over time and help to counter or fight off transience. The other thing that we can do that is kind of like a notebook, but without actually writing things down, is just bringing memories to mind frequently, particularly in the days or weeks after they occur. Those things we want to remember benefit greatly from rehearsal and repetition. And in fact, I think probably a major determinant, if not the major determinant, of the durability of a memory has to do with how often we think about and talk about the event later on. Those events that we tend not to talk about become increasingly less accessible. Those events that we do think and talk about become more accessible.
So talking with someone, with a friend or someone in your family over and over again about a significant event will really actually serve a function, which is to keep that event alive in an accurate way in your memory.
Absolutely. Particularly if you start talking about the event soon after it occurs, when memory tends to be more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we know, and it's nicely illustrated in that study of the O.J. Simpson trial, one of the things we know about memory and how it changes over time is that memory tends to be more literally accurate, more reproductive at soon after an event occurs. We have access to more of the details. Then as time passes, memory becomes more reconstructive. We lose the details and we hold on to the general sense or gist of what happened. So if you want to rehearse and retrieve memories and keep them alive, you want to start pretty soon because those details rapidly become inaccessible.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Schachter. He's chair of the psychology department at Harvard and author of several books about memory. His latest is called The Seven Sins of Memory, How the Mind Forgets and Remembers. Let's get to something I myself call proper noun disease that you call proper name anomia. Anomia means without name. And this is basically where you know a person or you know the title of something, you just can't remember what that name is. And struggle, though you will, you can't remember the name. And it's not like you don't know it. You just can't get it. Describe that phenomenon a little bit more.
Well, this is what I call the sin of blocking, and it's the third of the forgetting-related sins, along with transience and absent-mindedness. And blocking occurs when information is available in memory, as you describe. We have a cue present, It may be a person's face or some description of that person. And we're doing our best to remember, we're paying attention, but we simply can't get to the information. We may feel as though it's on the tip of our tongue. We may remember all kinds of things about the person or place we're trying to remember, but we just can't get to the name. So blocking can be very frustrating. It's a very normal phenomenon, occurs to all of us, tends to increase with age. And we've learned a little bit about parts of the brain that are involved in this phenomenon by studying patients with brain damage. And there are certain patients who have selective difficulties in coming up with names of people and places. And many of these patients tend to have damage in a part of the brain known as the temporal lobe, kind of sits next to your ear. And up toward the front tip of the temporal lobe, these patients often have damage. So some of us believe that this part of the brain plays an important role in allowing us to retrieve specific information about the names of people and places.
Now, here's something that's very confusing about this phenomenon. Sometimes, even though you can't remember the name, you know it starts with the letter V, or you think there's three syllables. Or you'll be able to think of somebody else's name that has one of the same syllables as this person's name, but you still can't get to this person's name. What is that about?
Well, that is, you know, perhaps the most intriguing aspect of the blocking phenomenon, that so much partial information can be available. And although we don't fully understand it, our best guess is that the name itself is kind of stored separately from the different kinds of constituent information that are related to it. So, for example, if I tell you that someone's name is John Baker, I'm not telling you anything about that person. If I tell you that someone is a baker, there's an immediate connection to all kinds of things that person does, where that person might work, and so forth. So proper names tend to be more isolated from other kinds of information. And this may be the reason why we're able to retrieve all these different kinds of information, but still not get to that proper name because it's kind of stored in an isolated manner.
The one of the disturbing things about this particular form of blockage is that sometimes you'll reach for a name, and not only, you know, aren't you coming up with it, but it's like you're looking into a void. You know, it's like you're looking for this name and there's nothing there. It's this big blank. And that's such a frustrating feeling.
It is. And one of the interesting things we've learned about this kind of name blocking is that the feeling you're describing becomes increasingly common as we get older. So when you look at tip of the tongue states and name blocking in younger adults, let's say college students, the more typical finding is that you have access to all this partial information, as we were just discussing a minute ago. You may know the first couple of syllables. You may know various things about the person. But as you get older, it becomes more common for the blocking state to feel like just drawing a total blank and not having access to all this partial information. So that is one of the signatures of blocking as we tend to get older.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Schachter. He's the chair of the psychology department at Harvard University and the author of several books about memory. He's led many research experiments about memory. His new book is called The Seven Sins of Memory, How the Mind Forgets and Remembers. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Daniel Schachter is my guest. He's the chair of the psychology department at Harvard and the author of several books about memory. His latest is called The Seven Sins of Memory, How the Mind Forgets and Remembers. Let's get to another fault of memory, which is suggestibility, that the mind is prone to suggestibility so that we might have a false memory or even make a false confession, you know, basically remember something that never happened. Would you describe this phenomenon a little more?
Yeah, suggestibility occurs when, as a result of being probed, for example, with leading questions, we come to remember events that never occurred. It doesn't take all that much in order to implant a false memory through suggestion. One example I give in the book involves an airplane crash that took place outside of Amsterdam a number of years ago. It was a terrible crash in the suburbs. There was tremendous media coverage of it. It was a plane that crashed right into an apartment building, and it was left devastation in its wake. Several months after this happened, a group of Dutch psychologists asked people from their university community about what they remembered about this crash. And among the questions they asked was a very simple one. Did you see the television film of the moment the plane hit the apartment building? And over half the respondents to this question said yes. Then they did a follow-up study, and two-thirds of the people who were in that study responded yes. And these people were able to provide details about the speed and angle of the plane when it crashed into the apartment building, whether it was on fire before it actually hit the building, what happened to the plane after it hit the building, and so on and so forth. Now, what's interesting about this is that there wasn't any television film of the moment when the plane hit the building. Now, they may well have remembered some news footage of what happened after the crash and sort of grabbed onto that information and built around it and built this memory of an event that never occurred. Now, this is particularly important suggestibility because it has ramifications in the legal context. When law enforcement agents, for example, have a hunch about who a suspect in a crime might be or where a crime may have occurred, if they ask leading questions, you may come up with the same kinds of memories that these Dutch researchers came up with in their study of the airline crash.
Sometimes there are things that we really want to forget. Traumatic events, negative memories, stupid things that we did. And often those are the things that really stick with us and keep coming back whether we want them to or not. As a psychologist who specializes in memory, do you think that there might be something adaptive or beneficial about our inability to forget things that we want to forget?
Absolutely. I think this might be the clearest example of the adaptive value of these memory sins. One example I give in the book of how overwhelming the persistence of memory can be comes from the baseball pitcher Donnie Moore, who pitched for the California Angels back in the 1980s. And in the sixth game of the 1986 American League playoff series against the Boston Red Sox, the Angels were on the verge of winning the pennant. There were two out in the bottom of the ninth inning. They were up by a run. Donnie Moore was pitching. There was a batter, Dave Henderson, up for the Red Sox. He had two strikes on him. The crowd was up cheering in California, thinking they were about to win the pennant. Moore's teammates were up in the dugout dancing around. Two outs, looked like he had him struck out. Moore throws the next pitch. Henderson hits it out of the ballpark. The Red Sox win the game and go on to the World Series. Donnie Moore became haunted by that memory. His life became taken over by that awful memory of what he had done, eventually leading to depression, divorce, and at the end, suicide. Now, while there must be more than just that single memory to account for all that happened to him, it's an example of how extremely disabling the persistence of memory can be. His teammates, when interviewed years later at the time of his suicide, said his memory for that pitch killed him. And yet, if we think about this kind of persisting memory for a traumatic event, it's a feature that we want in our memory systems. We want our memories to hold on to threatening events that could threaten our survival. So it may be one of the most adaptive features of memory that, in fact, we have special machinery that is devoted precisely to storing these emotionally arousing events in a way that will persist over time. But the cost of that, the cost that we pay, is the disabling sin of persistence.
Daniel Schachter, thank you so much for talking with us about memory.
My pleasure.
Daniel Schachter is chair of Harvard's psychology department. His new book is called The Seven Sins of Memory: How the Mind Forgets and Remembers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.